Charles Stewart, my next guest, was 4 when his dad died, his younger sister, 6 months old. Mum told them that dad had been very charismatic, pretty wealthy, cultured, highly educated, remarkably well-travelled. He, for example, he spoke fluent French and loved by everyone who met him. And he'd emigrated to Australia from England in search of greater opportunities. Now, he was much older than his wife, and the story was that he died of a heart attack at the age of 61. Well, the fact that Charles's mother and sister Barbara lived in a rented two-bedroom housing commission house in a working-class area of Perth was explained away by Mum, who said Dad had put everything into his Australian business enterprises, but on his death these had collapsed and all the money was lost. Now, many years later, after a mysterious phone call from his sister, Charles began the search for who his father really was, and he was shocked when he found out that Dad was a fugitive from the law, wanted at different times by the FBI, Scotland Yard and Interpol, an embezzler who'd consorted with gangsters in the 30s, a bigamist who'd been married 4 times, often at the same time, and that he hadn't died of a heart attack but had in fact committed suicide. Charles, you must still be in a state of shock.
Oh, initially I think I was, but I'm over that now, Philip. I just think the whole story is rather extraordinary, and I'm
ready. Say that again, and the film rights will be worth a fortune. Now, Charles, you only have the vaguest memories of your dad, and of course you're so young that the memories aren't entirely reliable, and you wouldn't pretend that they were.
No, that's right. I mean, one of the memories I had, and I always thought it was kind of a dreamlike thing, was standing in the passenger seat of the car while we drove past a familiar beachside landmark in Perth. And it was only when I started researching the book and realised that we had actually rented a house 2 blocks from that beachside landmark that I realised that that vague, hazy memory was perhaps a real one.
Many people, when you ask them their first memories, and I used to do it as a condition of being interviewed, will often remember not the incident, but a photograph from childhood. They can focus on a photograph, and you're pretty good at that as well too, because you remember photographs of your dad with always holding a cigar.
Yes, it became a fixture in his life, an affectation, and I think that it made him feel like the man that he really wanted to be, that is, a man of bearing, of substance.
Now, you must have romanticised your father. Certainly he was a romantic ideal for you to define yourself by.
Yes, I think that's the case, Philip, because I think that as men, we do tend to define ourselves somewhat by the person that our father was, you know, the path that he carved through life, the lives that he touched, the things that he did. And certainly growing up in fairly modest circumstances in very suburban Perth, I did feel different from my fellow playmates.
Well, you went further than that. You write that you often had a feeling that I would achieve things as if it was my birthright.
Yes. Yes, I did, because the story that I had was that my father was he was an officer. He'd studied medicine, you know, and he was a business success. And so for all of those reasons, you think, well, why can't I do that as well?
One day your sister Barbara rings to tell you she's begun an investigation into Dad. Why? Why did she do this? The investigation, not the phone call.
Well, I didn't know it at the time, but she'd been taunted as a child in the schoolyard by another child, or maybe several children, whose parents had obviously said to them, Morton Stewart, I know that surname. Their father was notorious. He was pursued by the police. And as a result, the child has said something to Barbara, my sister, and she's reacted. And anyway, it niggled at her for many, many years because Mum wouldn't tell her anything. And so she went to the Batty Library in Western Australia and looked up the newspaper archives around the time when our father had died. And there she found the glaring evidence that the story had many other elements that we had not been informed of.
One of them was that he'd committed suicide?
Yes, yes. It, you know, we were always under the mistaken belief that he'd had a heart attack. And no, what he'd done is he'd actually got in a hire car and driven off into the foothills of the Darling Ranges in Western Australia and taken an overdose of barbiturates.
Then other pieces of the puzzle come together. Newspaper headlines of the time referred to a failed attempt to extradite him to England. Why? Why do they want him back?
Well, there were several reasons, but probably the most prominent of them was that he'd worked as the manager of a travel agency, and in the course of his duties there, he had removed quite a large amount of money. And
he wanted the money to travel as well, I think. You know.
Yes, he did. And, yeah. And so he diddled the books and he put several thousand pounds in his pocket.
I love that, diddled the books. I haven't heard that for ages.
Well, I don't think that's a term he would have used.
Yeah, so this gets him into a bit of trouble. He makes headlines not only here.
That's right. Well, I even discovered a piece that was written about his escapades at this time in Time magazine, of all places. But no, he made the front pages of many of the English papers. The Sun especially lapped the story up in England, but also The Guardian and The Times and all the other great English papers. And then, of course, all the big Australian papers too, the Sydney Morning Herald, The Age, The West Australian, The Advertiser, they all had it front page.
And wasn't there at least a hint that he'd been married previously and simultaneously, or perhaps had other kids?
Yes, a lot of this came out at the time, and this was something I think that my mother was pretty unaware of. And an ex-wife came out of the woodwork when all the newspaper stuff started coming up. And she told a story of how she'd met him in the early 30s, and he had recently returned from America and had decided to go off and join the French Foreign Legion and write a book about it. And
I'm sorry, the French Foreign Legion? Yes. Did he actually do that?
Yes, he did. What was the background to that was that he'd been working in America and he'd done his trick with the books while auditing for a major company over there and embezzled them of a sum believed to be about $15,000 US.
That's a lot of money then, isn't it?
Oh, in 1930 it was a massive sum of money, absolutely massive. But when he absconded with about $2,500. And the FBI wanted him. And so instead of going straight back to England, what he did is went to the south of France, where he met this lady.
And that's not where the French Foreign Legion is.
No, but the stepping off point for the French Foreign Legion was there in Marseille. And he went across, his intention was to go across, join the French Foreign Legion in Algeria, which is what he subsequently did, masquerading as a Dutch doctor.
A Dutch doctor?
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry, this is wonderful.
Dr. Van Dien.
Well, it's wonderful, except it wouldn't have been wonderful to your mother. Now, here she is, the keeper of the flame, and little by little the story unravels, and that the idea of another wife, you know, and another life as distinct from that, must have been deeply wounding to her. How did she handle it?
Look, I think with shock initially, and from what I can work out, and there are newspaper accounts and interviews with her at the time, and, you know, through the tears and the realisation that there had been not one previous wife, but perhaps three previous wives, was such a shock to her. But then she said to the newspaper reporters, well, what do you expect, you know, a man of such bearing? Obviously, he's attractive to women. There must have been other women in his life. It hurts. I must go on.
And so I use the term keeper of the flame, but she certainly carried a candle, and she kept carrying it, didn't she?
Yes, right to the very end, right till her death 2 years ago at the age of 83. She never remarried. He died in 1955, and so for more than 50 years, she carried that love for him.
Why didn't she tell you something of this? Was it to protect you and your sister, or it was out of absolute loyalty to him?
Look, Philip, I think it was a combination of things. I think it was all of those things, but I also think that it was a part of the British sensibilities of the 1920s and 30s. The world that she grew up in was the, you know, English upper class, if you like. and you didn't display your dirty linen in public. You swept away the unpleasant things in your life and put them under the carpet.
True. So I think we had a jailbird in our family, someone who went into Pentridge for forgery, and boy, was that swept under the... Not under the carpet, we were too poor for carpet. It was swept under the Feltex.
Yes.
This is Late Night Live on ABC Radio National. I'm talking to journalist Charles Stewart about his search to find out the kind of bloke his father really was. He's written a book about it called The Rich Man, a fantastic title, great for the movie, which will probably star Mel Gibson. Now, Charles, before we go on, he had a lot of aliases. What was the name that he was born with?
He was born in Lanarkin, Scotland, in 1894, the name James Edward Morton. So I'm actually a Morton, and I didn't know it.
Mm. You went to Scotland, didn't you, to start your journey of discovery?
Yes, I went back to my what I now regard as my spiritual home, Lanarkin, Scotland, the home of William Wallace.
Yeah. Oh, is that right?
Yes, well, Wallace actually lived, according to legend, lived 100 metres from the house where my father was born, in a house with his wife, and his wife was murdered by the sheriff's men. And that began Wallace's crusade.
Was the story of your dad known at least in part in the neighbourhood?
Yes, it was. Because my father had two older brothers, and he had two aunts, and then a nephew. And so they all knew the story of James Morton. And his nephew, Tom, actually used to recount the story and looked upon him fondly as a bit of a rogue. That view wasn't shared by all, I might add, but certainly by young Tom, who was my cousin, I guess, it was.
Now, a quick read of this part of the history shows that due to deaths of one sort or another, the family could be described as somewhat dysfunctional.
Well, yes, I think that the life that my father came into, whilst for the time it was fairly privileged because his father ran a construction company in the area and was reasonably well off. His mother died when he was four, and then into the household came his 18-year-old aunt Nell, to run the household and look after the boys while grandfather William went off to run his construction business. So he was brought up without the real love of a mother and this very stern, hard, austere aunt ran his life for the next 10 years or so.
But then there was a lovely sort of moment in his life with Anne Forrest, a philanthropist who takes him under a wing. But we haven't got time for all of this. People are going to have to go out and buy at least one copy of the book. But your father, as you tell us, started to exhibit the behaviour that would go on for the rest of his life. A lot of extravagance and generosity, mixing with the best, playing the piano and being incredibly charming.
Yes, he certainly was. That all developed a little bit later on after his war service. And I think that part of it was a response to the life that he'd been shown by Anne Forrest, who was his other aunt, and she was the wealthy wife of a councillor in Edinburgh. And she showed him a little bit of the good life and encouraged him in his studies to go and study medicine and things like this before he went off to the war.
We've been discussing Freedom of Information a lot on the program lately, but you used the Freedom of Information Act to great effect, didn't you? You were able to retrieve his academic records from the university in Edinburgh. And all sorts of good stuff.
Yes, and also I targeted the FBI and the great resource in here in Australia, the National Archives, which contained a dossier on him that took me a year to get it in its entirety. But it's more than 3 centimetres thick, and it contains all sorts of correspondence, you know, from the then Immigration Minister Harold Holt to the Federal Police to the Commonwealth Immigration Authorities in Perth and Canberra, and all these messages going backwards and forwards about what to do with this man.
Now, your genes destine you, young man, to either becoming a wildly successful banker or an extremely successful at least briefly successful criminal, because one of your uncles goes to Canada, becomes a banker, and your dad did the same, but not successfully.
That's right. Uncle John, my older uncle, he was 5 years older than my father, 6 years older than my father. He'd gone into banking before my father had. But my father had encouraged him to join him in America, and he went across and joined the Canadian Bank of Commerce, worked his way up through that and ended up in New York, where he became the vice president of America's first major multinational company, the Singer Corporation. So he was a big swinger in the business world.
Now, one of the reasons Mel Gibson will insist on playing the part is because your dad fights at Gallipoli. And, of course, Mel's already co-starred in the movie. And after he recuperates, he goes AWOL. This is an odd thing to do. He's almost a hero.
Yes, but I think that if you understand what he'd gone through, like all those other men in trenches for 6 months in Gallipoli, they went over there with something like 1,200 men in their battalion. They came back with 286. They'd been through the most appalling, hideous deprivations. In the end, he was wounded. He was wounded just December the 18th, 1915, which was only 2 weeks before they pulled out. He was wounded in a feint attack to distract the Turks from the fact that the Anzacs were withdrawing from Anzac Cove further north up the Gallipoli Peninsula.
I've been talking about politics with a couple of characters in the last segment, and I'm wondering what his politics were. Did you divine that from your researches? Did he get a bit radicalised by Gallipoli?
Look, I honestly don't know the answer to that, Philip, but I think that it certainly would have affected him because, to see he was a young lieutenant, and to see so many of his comrades and his men killed for no good reason, he must have reflected on it at the end because it was such a folly, as we all know. And then being a man of some intelligence as well and fine education, he probably considered it fairly deeply, but then he thought, to hell with this, I'm not doing this anymore, I'm going to go and live a bit.
I'm going to ask you about concrete evidence of your father's criminal activities in the US, although it suddenly occurs to me that when you think about concrete and gangsters, it's usually people's feet being put in a bucket full of concrete. But after he goes to the States, after he's sort of not a country mile from Garbo and Gloria Swanson, the Barrymores and Eleanor Roosevelt, you do find concrete evidence that he's a naughty boy.
Yes. We discovered that he had, in fact, embezzled a large amount of money as an auditor working for a company there. But before that, he had apparently been consorting with members of the mob. And this was in the late 1920s. This was the roaring 20s in America, the days of the speakeasies, the days of prohibition, the days of Al Capone. And in fact, it is said that he was working as a bookkeeper for the mob.
In his defense, almost the entire American economy was working for the mob. The judiciary, the prison system, it was so corrupted, wasn't it, that he wasn't on his Pat Malone there.
No, that's right. But very soon after, a very notorious incident, which was the St. Valentine's Day Massacre, he left Chicago in a hurry. And it was rumoured that he had been the one who provided the money to the criminals to buy a Cadillac car, which they used to masquerade as police.
That's heavy-duty involvement in one of the most famous incidents in Prohibition history.
Yes, and the reason why people thought that my father was involved was twofold. Firstly, that he'd been working as a bookkeeper for them, and secondly, they knew that an accountant had given the mobster the money to go and buy the car, and he'd used the name J. Martin. And they assumed that J. Martin was a typographical error, and the name was actually J. Morton, my father's name. I can find no evidence of that, and the FBI files contain no evidence of that. In fact, they suggest the name of the person who gave them the money was an accountant by the name of Louis Lipschitz. But whatever the truth of that, my father left Chicago very quickly and adopted a different guise in neighbouring Minnesota.
People listening to this will not believe that we are just touching on aspects half the story. And we're going to jump ahead a bit because you and your mother were reunited with your dad in Perth after he'd spent some time in Fremantle Jail.
Oh, yes. Well, we're jumping now forward to about 1953, and this was when he'd had to leave England in a hurry after embezzling these funds from the travel agency. Also, apparently, according to the police in Britain, he was the centre of a smuggling, currency racket, jewellery smuggling business with five very well-known businessmen in the Midlands of England. So he took this money from the travel agency, wrote his own airline tickets, and jumped on an aeroplane and left my mother and I in his 21-room mansion in the Midlands of England. The rent was paid up for 3 months, and that was it. Mum had £100 to her name, and me, an 18-month-old baby to look after, and no idea of what my father was doing or why he'd gone.
I've got to say this. I think you should be very proud of him. Your father is one of the most extraordinary people I've encountered in a long life.
Yeah, I can't believe some of the things he did. I really can't. And even now, you know, I'm coming to understand some of it and some of the reasons for his actions, but I still find them incomprehensible.
So you're not sort of lapsing into pop psychology to explain him?
Well, I do a little bit. I do a little bit. And I think that part of the reason is that his experiences in war scarred him in more ways than one, as it did for so many young men. And the psychologists talk about the effects of war on young men not being just depression and suicidal tendencies and things like that, but also they say that many of them come out of the war profoundly changed morally. They come out of the war dishonest, and they talk about the effects of post-traumatic stress disorder, or shell shock, as they call it. But the other thing that I think was significant for my father was the fact that he was brought up in this loveless environment as a child, and the symptoms he displayed later on in life, the grandiose gestures and the wanting to appease people all the time.
Mate, we've got to wrap it. I'm sorry, yes. But people will rush out and get the book, wonderfully entitled The Rich Man, published by Storyboard. Thank you very much, Charles Stewart, and that's it for this week's program. Don't forget Classic on Friday, after the 10 o'clock news, repeated on Sunday morning, after the 4 a.m. news. Before I go, let me thank the team, well, to some extent, a new team. We welcome Amrutha Slee to the program. Thank you, Kate McDonald. Thank you, Paul Goff, Chris Short, and executive producer, Sasha Fegan. Stick around now on ABC Radio National for the news. Won't be anything like as interesting as Charles Stewart's book, and we'll see you later. Thank you.